Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. For those who have not been with us the last few days, the way we're working our agenda is based on, number one, I have a number of members here that have other tasks. We will be opening up public hearings and recessing them or closing them and then reopening them to take other testimony so I can get them on their way. So don't panic if you hear me open and close. That doesn't mean it's closed for good. The other things that we're going to be doing is the ones that are, quote, unquote, less controversial. We'll be moving them through the process quicker. So if we get bogged down in testimony on the ones that are going to be more controversial or a number of people who want to testify, we will not be holding up the process. As you can see on our agenda, we're working in basically an hour and 45 minutes, somewhere around 9 to 10 bills. So with that, I'm opening up the first public hearing on House Bill 2441A. And Council, go ahead and give us the preview now.
House Bill 2441A modifies current law that requires corroboration before a confession is admissible and creates an exception for sex crimes against vulnerable victims when the confession is deemed trustworthy and the victim is incompetent to testify. It removes language from the measure, the original measure that would have placed further restrictions on the admissibility of defendant's statements or conduct. It has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, I'm going to call up Representative Gelser to come up. And colleagues, those who are testifying, if you have written testimony, as well as for everyone else, realize we will be going through the testimony ourselves, so you do not need to. We ask you not to try to read it, or I'll be asking you to summarize. So with that, Representative, do you want to sign in and get us going?
Thank you. Chairman of the committee, I'm Sarah Gelser, representative from Corvallis. I appreciate your taking the time to hear this bill today. House Bill 2441 is a bill that a very large group of people have been working on for a very long time. In fact, I think the first conversation that Senator Bonamici and I had about this bill was sometime around February of 2008. This bill came out of a package of legislation that was dealing with vulnerable adults who are frequently victims of abuse. Adults with developmental disabilities, in particular, are frequent victims of sexual abuse. 80% of adult women with a developmental disability will be raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetimes. And of that 80% of those women, half of them will be raped or sexually assaulted 10 times or more in their lifetimes. And yet rarely are these cases prosecuted. One of the reasons is that these cases are very difficult to prosecute. You have victims who are frequently unable to ask for help after the problem has occurred. You have individuals who are often victimized by the people who are tasked to care for them. And as a result, you very rarely have rape kits. A person is very unlikely to rape or sexually assault someone and then take them to the hospital for a rape kit before they fix them dinner and dress them for bed. The other problem is that when the individual gets to court, these victims often don't make very good witnesses or are found not competent to testify in court. So the problem that we have is that even when a defendant has confessed to that crime, it's very difficult to obtain a conviction. There have been two recent Supreme Court cases here in Oregon in the last 2 years. The first happened in my legislative district where a man named Michael Simons was convicted of raping and sexually assaulted three Alzheimer's patients in his care at a local care facility, in addition to sexually assaulting several of his coworkers. Two of his coworkers. He confessed to all of these crimes, was convicted and sentenced to 99 years without the possibility of parole. This was appealed, and the Oregon Supreme Court dismissed the convictions for those crimes that were allegedly committed against those three elderly women with Alzheimer's because of the inability to corroborate that confession. A year later, in 2008, there was another case called the Delp case, and in this case, it was here in Marion County, I believe, and there was an investigation going on into an internet sex porn ring, and in the investigation, the subject confessed that he had been sexually molesting the toddler child of his girlfriend while he was enjoying his internet pornography. He, too, was convicted and sentenced, and that conviction was also overturned. It's very difficult to corroborate a confession when you have an 18-month-old victim. And in that case, the Supreme Court wrote, this issue requires us to confront, as we did recently in the State versus Simons, the difficult problem that arises when the victim of a confessed crime is incapable of recounting or perhaps even perceiving the injury or harm to himself or herself. And then it went on in one of the footnotes to state, this corpus delicti rule, as demonstrated in Simons and this case, can make it more difficult to obtain convictions based on confessions of crimes against particularly vulnerable victims. The state's concern about the result are properly addressed by the legislature. And that's why I'm here today. As we started this process, I, not being from the legal community, thought this is a crazy rule. We should just get rid of this corpus delicti rule. It's a very important rule. We do not want to convict people that falsely confess to crimes. There are all kinds of reasons why people might falsely confess to crimes. And I'm very grateful to a very large work group. We had about 30 people that worked and wrestled with this case. We had representatives of the defense, of the prosecution, of the Department of Justice. We also had Bronson James from the appellate division, who worked on both of the cases here. And after all of those discussions, what I moved forward was a much narrower bill. This bill allows a very, very narrow exception to the corpus delicti rule. It would be the narrowest exception in the nation. It would only apply when it is a sex crime, when it is committed against a vulnerable victim. And a vulnerable victim is a person that is elderly, a person that is developmentally disabled, or a child who... So they have to meet those qualifications, and the court has to determine that they are not able to testify in court. In addition to that, in a pretrial hearing, the court must determine that the confession itself is trustworthy. In doing that, the court must consider the means of interrogation. They must be able to the prosecution must be able to demonstrate that there is factual corroboration to the elements of the confession itself. So we move this forward to the House, and I'm going to go quickly. We moved this forward to the House. It passed unanimously in the House Judiciary Committee. The one issue that was raised by the defense attorneys was that they would prefer that this bill included the provision that these confessions be tape recorded. And while I generally support the idea of recordation of confessions, this is not the right place to provide it. The reason for this is these confessions are offered when there is no other evidence. So you would have to have some pre-knowledge before going in to do that discussion that this rule was going to apply. So it doesn't make sense to start in the most narrow place for a recorded confession when you don't know that you're going in to seek this confession in the first place. It doesn't make sense. And the House Judiciary Committee then moved this forward without that amendment. It then passed unanimously in the House Judiciary Committee, unanimously across the House floor. This week, we've had two more concerns that have been raised. They are addressed by amendments that you have before you. I believe they are the -6 and the -7. The first was a concern from the courts about having enough time to process the notice for the intention to use the confession. And the other was the question about where does the confession come from and how do we ensure that these confessions are not offered in a malicious kind of way from someone that has an ulterior motive. So the amendment that we have offered is the -5. I'm sorry, it's the -5 and the -7. The amendment that we have offered in the -5 adds to that list of what the judge must consider in making the trustworthiness determination, that the judge must consider the relationship between the individual who has confessed and the defendant. I also have for you an opinion from legislative counsel, which talks about this trustworthiness element and any concerns about someone offering a false report of a confession made. And so I'll offer that to you. This is a very good bill. We've worked hard. I think that we have addressed the concerns to the degree that we're able. I hope that you will be able to move this bill. I think that it is ready to go with these amendments once you've received your fiscals and revenues. And I'm happy to answer any questions. The Department of Justice is here. We have a district attorney here, but they have not signed up to testify given the time constraints, but are available if you have questions for them.
All right. Questions for the representative? Senator Boquist.
Just briefly to clarify, because we don't have the A5s. We want to move the A5 to the A7, is what Representative Gelsen is asking. Is that correct?
Correct. It would be the A5s and the A7s. And I thought that we had delivered the A5s yesterday, but I have... You do have it?
He has it. We don't have it yet.
Okay.
Have it.
Yeah. And the A7s we just brought this morning. They just came out. And those sevens are in agreement between the Judicial Department and the district attorneys. And the district attorneys can live with these -5s that adds that further protection on the trustworthiness.
Okay, any other
questions? Sure, I do have a question on page 2 of the bill. starting on line 16, vulnerable person means, are A, B, C, and D inclusive? They have to be all those or each one of those?
It must be one of those items. And if you turn back to page 1 in section 2, sub 1, for it to apply, all of these other pieces must apply, including on line 21, the victim is incompetent to testify under ORS 40310. So just because you're 67 years old doesn't mean it applies. You have to actually be incompetent to testify
in
court.
Thank you. You wrote me out of the bill.
Pardon?
Say thank you. You wrote me out of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gelser, I want to thank you and everyone who worked on this bill. I just want to say that I do support, I haven't seen the dash fives yet, but I do support the dash sevens because I was concerned about the time frame being tied to the trial date because depending on which jurisdiction you're in, trial dates are so fluid and tying it instead to the arraignment I think makes more sense. So I'm glad to hear that. It seems that you're in support of that as well. So.
I am absolutely in support of it. Everyone that has worked on this bill has worked very hard, particularly this week. Very grateful to Bronson James and also to the Judicial Department, Nancy Cozine, to the District Attorney's Office and the District Attorneys Association, and to the Department of Justice, who have all worked very, very hard to get a tight, well-crafted, narrow bill. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Representative, thank you very much. And at this point, I'm going to temporarily close House Bill 2441A, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 3271A to take Representative Stegler's testimony. So we'll open that public hearing, 3271A.
House Bill 3271A increases the penalty for harassment under certain circumstances when a person subjects the victim to alarm by conveying a threat to inflict serious physical injury against the victim or victim's family, or to commit a felony against the person or property of the victim or victim's family, clarifies when the conduct is elevated to a Class C felony, and you should have A3 and A5 amendments as well. There's no revenue or impact and a minimal fiscal with no statement issued.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Stigler. I'm House State Representative from House District 54 in Bend, and I'm the primary sponsor of House Bill 3271. And I brought this forward originally to try to bring us up into the 21st century. We had some provisions of harassment statutes regarding some electronic harassment. But I wanted to get the definition updated, number one, and also to recognize that some of these situations can be, I would classify them as quite dangerous in particular. And this was geared off of a lot of the cases that you've seen across the country in the last couple of years and the apparent inability to deal with these at the criminal justice level. So essentially what this bill did was three things. It elevated harassment conduct to a felony under certain circumstances, and those are set out currently in under subsection 2, B, big A, B, C, and D, and then under section 1, excuse me, and then also it establishes a definition of electronic threat, which is consistent. What we tried to do was go throughout the statutes, the criminal statutes, where there are references to electronic threats and make the definition consistent so that we don't have a definition one place and it's different in another place. And then finally what it does is clarifies where jurisdiction would lie, which is either in the county where the electronic transmission originated or where it was received, so that it could be prosecuted in either county. And wanted to just touch briefly on the elevation. In previous legislative session, and I can't remember whether it was last time or the time before, certain harassing behavior was elevated to a misdemeanor. This takes that and takes those situations, it expands it, but it also, it's the same kind of behavior. Essentially, it's the behavior where there is there are threats, there are specific threats that are made for bodily injury, and they're made repetitively, or they're made under certain other circumstances, such as when there's a stalking order, a restraining order, those kind of circumstances, and elevates it to a felony. Now, I understand that there are some amendments. I haven't seen the amendments. The chair and I have talked briefly about those before. I know that there's some other harassment statutes that he wants to sort of bring all in line in this one. And he indicated that probably one of them was to reduce it back down to, I'm assuming, an A misdemeanor for the repetitive behavior. And I don't have any opposition to that. I just want us to recognize that this is not acceptable behavior. It's becoming much more pervasive in our culture. And, you know, I think that it has... We've seen instances where it has done a lot of harm. I'm happy to take any questions. And again, I haven't seen the amendments, but from my conversations with Senator Przlonski,
Let me just put on the record for our colleagues. The goal here is right now harassment is a Class B misdemeanor, and that's offensive physical contact. Based on what Representative Stegler has brought forward, we'll have an amendment, if we don't have it now, that's going to have this her situation become a Class A misdemeanor. Then we're going to have another one that's going to actually be aggravated harassment, which will include a different component as it pertains to corrections officers and police officers. The goal here by the chair is to keep the type of conduct uniformly in the correct, or what I would say the appropriate, statutes. So offensive physical contact does not require injury. That's why these will all be considered harassments. Right now we have for the corrections officers as an assault 3, and there's no injury required to prove that. We're going to keep the same penalties. We're just going to rename it.
And that makes perfect sense to me to bring them all within the harassment statute. And as I said, we talked about the elevation, and my understanding was we'll keep it at a more elevated level of an A misdemeanor for certain types of harassment behavior. And I'm fine with that.
Any questions for the representative? Thank you very much for being here this morning.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this point, and we'll reopen later House Bill 3271A. And now I'm going to go ahead and open up the next public hearing, which is going to be 2478A. And we'll give Council an opportunity to get to the
House Bill 2478A modifies the crime of sexual abuse in the second degree to include intentionally propelling a dangerous substance in another person, clarifies that the act must be done with the intent to gratify the sexual desire of the offender. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Scott Ruin. I represent Tualatin and Westland in Oregon House. I appreciate you hearing House Bill 2478A today. This bill came about because of a recurrence that happened about a year ago in the spring. There was a young mother in a Target store in Clackamas County. She was with her 3-year-old daughter just shopping. There was a man that, and I'm sorry, it's so early in the morning, but to describe the story, but I'll do it anyway. A man who was stalking her basically in the aisles, masturbated, propelled his semen onto her. She didn't know it. She didn't know it until it happened, and he ran out of the store. He was, after some widespread media coverage of this, he turned himself into the Clackamas County Jail. A few days later, he was arrested, booked, and then released, was tried last summer. And although the DA in Clackamas County tried to pursue this as a sexual assault 3 originally, they were not able to get that done. And basically, the only sentence that this particular person received, and the only crime, if you will, given the current statute, was a harassment. A misdemeanor harassment charge. Chair, you and I had a conversation about this. It would basically be the same sort of harassment as if somebody were to take a box of popcorn or a Big Gulp and dump it in somebody's lap. And it appeared to a few of us that there was something different about a Big Gulp and propelling semen onto somebody. So hence, that's where we have this bill. It would turn that, it would call any non-consensual flinging, if you will, of bodily substances, including semen, urine, feces, and blood, excuse me, done for sexual gratification, would turn that into sexual harassment, too.
Thank you.
That's it.
Thank you.
Any questions for the representative?
I just have a brief question. I understand this is a practice that sometimes occurs in prisons as well.
It is. That's a great question, a great comment. There's something absolutely different between a prisoner flinging urine or feces or even semen on a warden when it's assuming not done for it's not done for sexual gratification versus something that is done for sexual gratification. So part of the amendment process in the House Judiciary Committee was to make sure that it's clear that this act is done. Was done for the sexual gratification of the offender. Also made clear with the amendment that that this is non-consensual. So if there's consent to this, there will be an AA.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions for the representative? Thank you very much for being here. I'm going to go ahead and temporarily close the hearing at this point on House Bill 2478A. And for the purpose of taking testimony from another member, I'm going to open up House Bill 2727A.
House Bill 2727A exempts information identifying the holder or applicant for a concealed handgun license from being released to the public unless the requester can establish by clear and convincing evidence that the public interest in disclosure outweighs the holder's privacy. It allows a CHL holder to request notification from the sheriff that there is a records request for the permit and requires the custodian of records to consider any information the holder provides prior to making the decision to release the holder's information. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal news statement.
All right, Representative, before you get started, is Commissioner Leonard here? Okay, I was going to go ahead and put him on just to get him back to Portland, but I guess we'll have to wait. Senator, Representative, please go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, my name is Jeff Marker. I'm state representative from House District 28, Beaverton, Iowa. I'm here in support of House Bill 2727. This is about privacy of individuals. The sheriffs of both Multnomah County and Washington County came and testified about the need for this bill. They don't want to be litigating this daily for the next, foreseeable future. What this bill does, and it was a compromise bill, we worked it over very hard. Representative Steger and Olson put the concealed handgun licenses back into public records to cover some concerns of the newspapers and so on, but put them in the Section 502 so that they're not readily available to the purient interest of somebody. This is kind of about, does the purient interest of the public outweigh the privacy of the law-abiding citizen? I want to emphasize these people are law-abiding citizens. We had some red herrings run out over on the Senate, on the House side, saying, well, shouldn't a battered woman be able to know if her battering spouse has a concealed handgun license? A spouse batter is a criminal. Criminals don't obey the law. There would be no reason to expect that a criminal would have a concealed handgun license. If he did have one and the sheriff knew about these kind of activities, he wouldn't have it. They would take it away from him. This bill passed on our side 54-4 on the House floor, and one of the no votes was because they didn't think the bill was strong enough.
I'll wait.
I'd like for you to come up, and I'm trying to move this through, Jenny. And I have
two people with me.
Well, they're not going to testify with you because I've got so much more I have to get done. I'm trying to get members taken care of, and I just can't hold it all up.
And you may hear some testimony about public officials having people know that they have concealed weapons permit. We're public officials, so we're used to being more in the limelight. And this bill is to protect the average law-abiding citizen who isn't in the limelight, who doesn't want publicity. This is an important law to protect the privacy, again, I'll just say one more time, of the law-abiding citizen. Many of you know my daughter Heidi, who's a deputy district attorney in Portland, who's 5'4", who has recently tried and convicted two people of murder in a gang murder up there, sent two gang people to the prison for life. Now, when Heidi's walking down the street, does she have a gun permit or not? Should these people be able to call up and say, is that young woman carrying the .357 heavy frame pistol her father gave her with the high velocity federal ammunition in it? Or not? I suggest they should not. I suggest the privacy and protection of people is more important than the pure interest, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Senator, I'm sorry I can't accommodate having your other witnesses come in together, but I need to get members in and out. I will take Commissioner Leonard's testimony if he needs to get back to Portland so we can get him on his way at this time. But if you would like to wait till we get the other, get back, because this bill is going to be our last one, because I have a number of people who want to testify on that. So I'll give you your choices how you'd like to proceed.
I guess I'll wait till I can bring my panel up.
Okay.
It'll be Commissioner Leonard and Mr. Caldwell.
Okay.
Thank you.
I can't tell you what time it's going to be. We'll get to it as quick as we can. I just want to clear this out. All right. All right. Any questions for Representative Barker?
Just for the record, the representative, the clear and convincing part, could you just put on the record your interpretation of that and how we're going to get sheriffs to support that or enforce that?
Okay. Clear and convincing is a legal term. Thank you, Senator, for that question. Clear and convincing is a legal term. It's just below beyond a reasonable doubt. So that if somebody needs to know, has a real valid reason to know, for example, if a sheriff is mishandling this for some reason, giving to people he shouldn't or something, the press would find out. It, with a very little investigative reporting, a little investigative digging, they would be able to find that. They would be able to go to the court and say, we have clear and convincing evidence the sheriff is mishandling that. At that time, the court could take a look at those and open those records up. But it's a high standard. It isn't just because I want to know if you or your wife has one. It would have to be some very valid reason, and that's to protect the privacy of the citizens.
Yes.
Just one follow-up. I've probably got hundreds of emails now, about 75 or 80 from my district, and it all focuses on one thing, is if the newspaper comes and asks for all the records of the teachers at the Newburg High School, is that clear and convincing in your mind?
No, they'd have to have some very valid reason to know that.
Thank you.
All right. And Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barker, you mentioned prurient interests a couple of times and weighing that with privacy rights. Might there be situations where someone would have an interest that wasn't prurient in finding out whether someone had a concealed permit?
There might be, but I don't know what it is. I don't know why that would overweigh somebody's privacy. If you own guns, you can have however many guns you want in your home today without a permit. You could carry a gun on your hip without a permit, exposed. So this only covers whether you are allowed to have a concealed weapon. The police can check that out. When I was active, even those many years ago, 2001 when I retired, if I pulled you over and I punch in your driver's license or your car license, I could immediately get a flag on my computer screen saying, has concealed handgun license. And that was always a good thing to me, because then I knew I had a law-abiding citizen I was dealing with. It was much safer than walking up on somebody who I didn't know who they were. But there may be, but I don't know what that would be. I don't know where that would outweigh the citizen's right to privacy.
All right, any other questions? All right, I'm going to go ahead and temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2727A. Thank you. And we'll start with 2260.
Thank you.
46.
Got it.
And we're going to open up our public hearing on House Bill 2246A.
House Bill 2246A modifies conditions under which a parent or guardian may give alcohol to a person under 21 years of age. It creates an exception for wine provided during a religious rite or service. No revenue or fiscal impact.
I have only one person scheduled to testify, Linda.
Good morning, Chairman Stansky, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Linda Ignalski. I'm the Regulatory Services Director at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2246A, and hopefully I can do this very quickly for you. 2246A proposes to add language to our current statute to clarify that parents and guardians may provide alcohol to a child only in a private resident and when they're accompanied by their parent or guardian. This would make it consistent in how it's always been interpreted, and also would make it consistent with the current minor in possession law. The minor in possession law states that a minor can only possess alcohol in a private resident in the presence of a parent or guardian. However, Statute 471.410 does not specify this. So we're trying to just clarify this for everyone. Parents, sometimes parents and legal guardians are confused. They believe reading the language of the current statute allows them to give minors alcohol in any public location. They are unaware of the minor possession law. This creates confusion with extent to the parents, and we're just trying to clarify that and add this language so it's consistent with the minor possession law.
All right, thank you. Any questions for our witness? Senator Boquist.
Just a legal interpretation, and either she might be able to answer or counsel. Private residence, or are we talking about the physical building? You know, example, you know, a person has a 1 acre, 2 acres in the rural area, the house sits on the property and they're having an event outside, you know, a family event at the picnic table outside. Is that a private residence or not a private residence?
Part of the language here.
Yeah.
What I would say is that part of the language here I see is exercises control over a private residence. I think you'd have difficulty establishing that a person was violating that if they were outside the home but on the private property, although I would have no problem talking to legal counsel. I mean, council downstairs and making sure that they agree with that.
I'm just trying to define for the record what it is, what it isn't.
Well, we can set a record right now.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that the intent would be under this is that if a person, minors with their parent outside of their house but on their property that's within the description for that private residence, that they would in fact be included within the private residence definition.
Chairman Przanski, that would be correct.
All right.
That's reasonable.
If they're outside of their private property, which is their residence, then there would be potentially some issues.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, Senator Gormici?
Mr. Chair, I just a clarification. I don't think it needs to be their residence. It says a private residence.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Yeah, I agree. I think it could be any residence that's private. It's when they go onto public property as where the issue, or if they were in a premises that provides alcohol, such as a restaurant, there could be an issue there too.
That's correct.
All right. Any other questions? Not, then thank you very. Let me ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2246. Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2246A.
Mr. Chairman, 2246A, the floor will be passed.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2246A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Volunteer on this one. Senator Dingfelder will be our carrier on this one. Thank you. You may. Just get permission from the president before you do so. All right, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2246A. And we're going to open up our next public hearing, which is going to be on House Bill 2426A.
House Bill 2426A imposes a minimum fine of $2,500 and mandatory jail for a person convicted of a DUI with a blood alcohol level BAC of 0.2% or greater reduces the threat. Pardon me. The amended bill that is passed in Gross reduces the threshold BAC to 0.15% and removes the provision requiring jail time. So it's a $25,000 mandatory fine.
$2,500.
Yeah, there it is.
We have an amendment.
Okay. So basically, let's say I've got Chuck Hayes and then Mike. I can't. Your last name looks like an I W I A. Okay, and if you'd like to come on up, or are you just here for questions if necessary? All right, thank you very much. Chuck, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this quick. Good morning. I'm Chuck Hayes, the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2426. And also the amendment to actually change the fine, reduce the fine from $2,500 to $2,000. Our committee, we believe and support this bill because of the fact that we know that high-risk DUI offenders are a problem. It's not something that is a new concept. dealing with high BAC offenders, repeat offenders especially. We know that 41 states around the country have enacted such laws that address this. Oregon is not one of those laws that has. We also know that high BAC offenders are at least 20 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than a sober driver, and they're also more likely to commit the crime of DUI again. So the objectives of this bill and this law would be to create enhanced sanctions for those high BAC offenders of 0.15% or higher so that we could deter their high-risk behaviors and also reduce recidivism. Statewide statistics that the state police was going to provide and was that we know that we have data from 2006 that reveals that 136 deceased drivers were tested for alcohol here in Oregon. And of those, 84 or 62% of those had a blood alcohol level of 0.15% or higher. So we are starting to see those with the fatal crashes, especially in that 0.16 to 0.19% range. So this bill, House Bill 2426, recommends that DUI offenders with those high BACs of 0.15% or higher would receive increased sanctions. And also, this is kind of important to us as well, Mr. Chair, because federally, the federal government is providing money, dollars to the states that have enacted these laws of having the enhanced BAC offenders and some law that will address that. So it is important to us in here in Oregon that we would qualify for that federal funding, and this would help in that regard.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Hayes? All right, thank you very much. And let me just see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2426A. Not seeing anyone, will close the public hearing on a work session on House Bill 2426A.
Mr. Chair, move the A2 into 2426.
Senator Boquist moves the A2 into House Bill 2426A. Any discussion? I just want to put on the record the reason that we're doing this is because when you look at the current sentencing structure for individuals that are being convicted of DUI on multiple offenses, the threshold is $2,000. So to make it consistent with those, that is why we're dropping it from 25 to 2,000. Does not mean that's the limit, but that's the starting point. So it's in, let's say, congruent to what is already in statute. Any other discussions or statements? Any objection to the
Mr. Chair?
Senator Boquist? Excuse me, Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, we'll support the bill. I'm a little concerned on a couple points requiring mandatory jail time. It concerns me. I feel like we're a bit boxed in because of the risk of losing the federal funds. And also I noticed that if we had the funding to add another DUII court, that might be an alternative to doing this. And obviously we don't have additional funding for that at this point. So I'll support the bill with some hesitation.
All right, let me see if I can address, or if not, council can address the mandatory jail. In a DUII, there's a mandatory requirement of the person to serve 48 hours or the court can impose community service with a specific limit, meaning a minimum of 80 hours. And I'm assuming that's what it is. It's not requiring a higher threshold.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Also, the fact that in the original bill, which I had on the House side, did impose a greater amount of jail. When I did the measure summary for you, I left any information covering kind of the history of it, so I'm sorry I didn't streamline it, but that portion has been taken out, and Mr. Chair is correct. The only mandatory jail now is associated with the DUI in
Thank
general.
You.
All right. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion to move the bill to the floor?
Ordering the amendment.
Or the amendments, that's right. All right. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2426A as amended with the A2 to the floor with two pass.
All right, Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2426 as amended by the A2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Wissett will be our carry on 2426A. All right, we're going to take up the companion one next, which is House Bill, close that work session, open up a public hearing on House Bill 2427.
House Bill 2427 creates a penalty for persons who refuse to submit a blood or urine test as required by the implied consent law. You have dash one amendments that remove blood test from that. But it says no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued, I believe.
Okay. At this point, I have three people that I believe are wanting to testify. Ann Pratt, Jody Beretta, and then Trooper EY. Were you going to be testifying on this one? Or?
Sure, yes.
Okay. Why don't you three please come up at this time? Whoever would like to get started.
Good morning, sir, and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt, for the record. I'm testifying this morning on behalf of Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm also a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. House Bill 2427 is about responsibility, accountability, and public safety. The purpose of House Bill 2427 is simple. Is to get at the truth by prompting DUI offenders to submit to chemical tests when asked to do so by law enforcement. It is the best evidence of guilt or innocence. It's about identifying the intoxicated drivers and getting them off our roads and reducing the threat to the general public. Drivers who refuse tests are very often considered high risk. That is defined by those who have alcohol or substance abuse problems and drive intoxicated on a regular basis. These high-risk drivers are a huge problem in our country and state, and they are already resistant enough to change. So let's not make it easy for them to escape responsibility and accountability by allowing them the privilege of refusing a blood or urine test without a fine. If I were stopped and had been drinking, I can only think of one reason to refuse. I might be found legally intoxicated and guilty of driving under the influence if I complied, and possibly I had been down this road before. Repeat offenders are often advised by their attorneys to refuse. Prosecutors do prosecute, but without that evidence, it is much more difficult. It takes more time, and time in the courtroom equates to dollars. I would expect this fine to prompt more refusers to comply. Is offenders who refuse the test tend to have higher recidivism rates and more previous offenses. I believe every man, woman, and child has the right to safe roadways in Oregon, to be safe on the way to the grocery store, a child on his bike on his way to his grandmother's house, or to simply drive up the freeway. We need all the tools and resources possible to get these offenders off our roads. It also has another goal and purpose, and if we identify them, we can also get them into the necessary treatment, and I certainly do support treatment that is proven to work. House Bill 2427 passed on the House floor by 59-0. It supports good public safety. It is supported by Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Governor's Advisory Committee, Crime Victims United, Oregon District Attorneys Association, and the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. Please support this bill. Pass this bill. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Jody?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Jody Beretta. I'm a Marion County Deputy District Attorney, and I'm here today representing ODAA in support of this bill. I believe that this bill would serve as both a deterrent against refusing to take a urine test and also as an appropriate sanction for those who refuse to comply with the current implied consent law. The bill would close a gaping hole that we currently have in our ability to hold drugged drivers accountable for putting the safety of our citizens in danger. This would make it a separate offense to refuse to take a urine test, just as it is already a separate offense to refuse to take a breath test. We need to give the law of implied consent a little bit of teeth by having a consequence. Currently, the only consequence for refusing to take a urine test is an increased driver's license suspension. Well, that doesn't touch people who are either unlicensed or out-of-state drivers. It just doesn't make sense to not have a consequence for people who refuse to comply and still drive drugged on our streets. the law should not distinguish between a drunk driver and a drugged driver, and this bill would put those two each other and hold the drugged driver just as accountable as we've already chosen to hold the drunk driver. I would ask the committee to pass this bill.
All right, thank you. Trooper.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael EY. I'm a senior trooper employee with the Oregon State Police and been with them for over 13 years. As an agency, obviously, we are remaining neutral on this House bill. However, I think I have some statistical data that you may want to hear. Currently, my position is on the Drug Evaluation Classification Program State Coordinator, which means that I have 190 drug recognition experts that I oversee and make sure that we provide quality training. There are several NHTSA and IACP curriculums that are being taught to our recruits that are police academies, and some of which are a direct impact under the program in which I manage. And speaking with House Bill 2427, I'm going to give you some statistics. In 2007, there were 16,836 breath test refusals.
Still around the testimony.
3,620, correction on that, there were breath test failures, and then there were 3,620 breath test refusals, 201 urine refusals, and 117 blood refusals. Similarly, for 2008, there were 3,489 breath refusals, 148 urine refusals, and 98 blood refusals. As the DECP state coordinator, we did 1,247 drug evaluations for 2007, where 51 suspects refused to provide urine. So the opinion of the evaluator could not be corroborated based upon toxicology. For 2008, we did 1,159 drug evaluations, where approximately 27 to 30 had refused to give us urine. And again, it fails to corroborate the opinion of the evaluator. We do know that there are license sanctions already in place with the implied consent law. However, there is not a standalone on all biological specimens when an individual refuses to provide urine and or blood, meaning that there's not a way to issue an additional citation. Currently, costs and a half of the fines collected in circuit court are credited to the state criminal fines and assessments, or the CFAA account, which OSP does not receive. When the OSP issues a citation for refusing the breath test, remaining monies are redirected to state police and used for OSP forensics. Last year, OSP received $52,394. This bill would redirect on how these funds would be allocated. I will also say with this fund is it's very difficult to obtain that money in speaking with our fiscal, because if they're indigent or if they're unable to pay, then that money does never go to that account. With the implementation of this bill, OSP is the arresting agency. Costs and a half of the fines collected in circuit court would go directly to the OSP intoxicated driver account. If the violation was processed through a municipality or a city, then the first half credited the city, and through a justice court, the county. The remaining balance is subject to division in accordance with state law. A revenue increase is expected to the intoxicated driver account. However, that amount is indeterminate. Mr. Chair, a member of the committee, that concludes my testimony.
Trooper Ewing, thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I had one other person who's asked to testify on this, and that's on House Bill 2427, Andrea Meyer. Why don't you come forward if you want to testify? Was there anyone else besides Ms. Meyer who wanted to give testimony on this bill? All right. You didn't sign up.
I'll be quick.
Yes, you will be.
Okay.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We continue to have concerns about the implied consent law. I am not testifying that driving is a right, but we do have a Fourth Amendment that requires a process to go to before a person can be searched. And we don't believe that necessarily you give up your basic fundamental rights when you get on the road. Certainly, to be clear, this is not to address the underlying significant problem of drunk driving, but it's the concern that we have about creating a new offense when someone refuses to submit to a blood test when there's not been a court order requiring them to do so.
Ms. Meyer, let me just let you know, we have a dash one that's going to take the blood out. The urine will be the only part that will be moving forward on this bill. Does that make any difference in your testimony?
I guess.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 2427? If not, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2427, opening a work session on House Bill 2427.
Chair, move the A1 to 2427.
Senator Boquist moves the dash ones into House Bill 2427. Again, this will remove the feature of taking requiring blood and only require the urine to be submitted when requested under a proper request. Any other comments? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2427 as amended with the A1 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2427 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just noted that there is going to be some cost to the Department of Transportation to make some programming changes. It looks like it's a little less than $14,000, but they may come back. So I just wanted to, for more, they said during to the emergency board. So I just wanted to point that out.
All right.
We're doing things that cost money.
All right. With that, any objection to the motion? So ordered. And the carrier on this one will be the chair. All right, Senator Boquist wants to be the carrier. We'll let Senator Boquist be the carrier. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2427. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2529A.
House Bill 2529A modifies the procedure for impounding a fighting bird during an investigation for criminal mistreatment, authorizes an officer to apply for a search warrant and impound animals in cases involving animal fighting, requires a person convicted of sexual assault of an animal to report as a sex offender, no revenue, impact, minimal fiscal, with no statement issued.
All right. Ms. Harlan, why don't you come forward? Was there anyone else who's going to want to give testimony on 2529A? Go ahead and sign in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Humane Society. We support this bill. It came out of the House 60-0. It's essentially a housekeeping bill that rolls the animal fighting statutes into the other animal crimes that allow for emergency care, early forfeiture upon probable cause, which is an enormous cost-saving benefit to animal control agencies across the state. It requires education at the cost to the person upon conviction, and with respect to fighting birds, allows for an option of impound on property. One of the things about fighting cocks is that they're simply angry birds. And trying to deal with 500 or 1,000 of these birds in a small rural animal control facility is just unrealistic and dangerous. At least it provides the option to impound on property until other accommodations can be made. We support this bill. Thank you. Any questions, I'm happy to take.
All right. Any questions? Senator Bonamici.
I just have a question for counsel. Counsel, I believe that you mentioned something about registration as a sex offender or reporting as a sex offender, and I'm just trying to track and see if that was taken out of the bill on the House side. It looks like there was an amendment that might have deleted that portion, and maybe Sharon's nodding her head, so... Ms. Harmon,
I may have actually not been there for the day when they took that out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonamici, it was amended out, unfortunately.
All right, any other questions? Any other comments? All right, thank you. Yes, I'm sorry, Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Krasinski. This authorizes an officer to apply for a search warrant. This would be one of the newly... anointed humane officers would then be, according to the bill we just passed the other day, if that becomes law, then the humane officer would be able to apply for a warrant, and then it would allow the warrant would allow for impounding the animals on the premises and I assume occupying the premises.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, in the terms of fighting cocks, my experience is only in California doing this, and it was a 1,200 fighting cock operation. We impounded on premises, and the state Bakersfield County Sheriff, paid for security for that, not for the two nights that the birds were there until the courts provided an order to destroy the birds.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you for coming forward. Close that public hearing. We're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2529A.
Chair, move House Bill 2529A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2529A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So order. Senator Bolamici, will you carry this one, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And now we've got, I don't see Mr. Bronson stop back, correct? Then we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3271A. That's reopening it. And so I'm going to call Brian DeLastma up, please.
I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association.
Chair, 1 minute or 4 minutes?
One. Thank you.
Less is more.
The amendments, the Dash 3 amendments, are offered by the chair. They actually incorporate the content of House Bill 2401 that was passed the House unanimously. In reference to Senator Whitsitt's question earlier on a different bill, currently the statute has an assault by bodily fluids for correctional officers. This just expands the assault to line staff as well. So we're talking parole and probation officers, police officers, emergency and medical technicians, and firefighters. So if they get intentionally propelled the bodily fluids onto them, that's an assault as well. What the chair has done with the Dash 3 amendments is take 2401, which was in an assault section, assault by bodily fluids. He has moved it to the current statute and the future statute into an aggravated harassment statute. So it's aggravated harassment rather than assault by bodily fluids. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. I have written testimony and examples. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions? No questions. All right. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on, hang on 1 second, on 3271? We're not planning on working the bill today. There's a couple of things we need to confirm, Gail, so if you want to wait on that. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this time on House Bill 3271. And now we're going to get into our other two. I think we will go ahead and do that. Let's go ahead. We're going to go ahead and put on the record for House Bill 3271. We're going to carry this one over until Tuesday, May 26. That's when we'll bring it back. Hopefully we'll have all the amendments together. And if we need to take an additional testimony, Ms. Meyer will do that at that time. So that's so ordered. Mr. Bronson, you're just right on time. Open up a reopened House Bill 2441A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bronson James. I'm Chief Deputy Defender at Oregon's Office of Public Defense Services. I'm here today to talk briefly about 2441A, and I'll keep it relatively brief. We worked extensively with Representative Gelser in this bill, and I definitely want to begin by commending the process with which she used to draft this bill. She spent a lot of time, talked to many, many people, was very inclusive in that process. And as a result, when this bill was originally, before the House, the Office of Public Defense Services took a neutral position. It wasn't until after that time, however, that we became aware of an aspect of the bill that, quite frankly, I had simply overlooked previous to that. This is 100% my fault, not Senator Gelser's, and I simply should have caught this earlier. This bill had arisen in the context of the Simons and Delp cases, which I had litigated, and as a result, when we had talked about this issue, it had always been within the context of interrogation by law enforcement. And I think when we talk about confessions in general, we have this sort of common parlance, you know, man on the street understanding of a confession being something that's given to law enforcement. Well, the state of Oregon law is such, and this is really my point here today, is I want to make absolutely sure the committee understands the lay of the land legally as to where this bill fits. A confession is not a statement to law enforcement under Oregon law. A confession is any statement made to any person for the purposes of acknowledging guilt. And thus, this bill has the potential to, for one citizen to simply say another citizen confessed to me that they abused their two-year-old, for instance. So husband and wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, friends, even complete strangers can confess to each other. We see this as a potential problem in the bill. And as I said, not one that we had originally keyed in on until, unfortunately, it went through the House. I want to state for the record that absent this sort of hole in the bill that we perceive, the rest of the bill, the Office of Public Defense Services is neutral on. We would want to express our concerns about the potential for false confessions and ultimately false convictions by casting such a wide net due to the nature of confessions. We do think there is a potential very easy fix, which would be to simply say that for the exception to apply, it would be a confession to a peace officer or federal officer. Those are already statutorily defined terms and would be relatively easy to reference. With that fix in, our position would again be neutral towards the rest of the bill. The other thing, just sort of briefly, I want to make the committee aware of, just again so that we understand the full lay of the legal land in which this bill plays, the confession corroboration requirement in Oregon, in fact, predates statehood here. It was in effect in the common law in this territory, inherited from England. It's roughly 400 years old. It's been on the statute books in Oregon since 1864 and has remained essentially unchanged until this bill. So it has a very long history of application in the state. We fully understand Representative Gelsa's concerns about the prosecution of vulnerable victims. They are very legitimate concerns. We commend her for making a proposed change that is a very incremental step away from that time-honored and tested rule, and we commend her for not sort of going wholesale with the pendulum in the other direction. Nevertheless, we did want to raise to this committee's awareness what we perceive as a potential hole in the bill, and at that point I'm open for any questions that the committee might have.
Right. Mr. James, I know that you have another commitment that you need to leave for, so I'm going to ask the committee if you have any questions for Mr. James. Senator Bonamici.
Mr. James, did you discuss this particular issue with Representative Gelser?
Representative Bonamici, Chair, we spent many times discussing the nature of confessions. And again, this is completely my fault, because during those conversations, we sort of always presumed that we were talking about a confession to a law enforcement official. And you kind of get stuck in a particular train of thought, and that was the universe in which I was analyzing this bill. And it wasn't until probably 4 a.m. in the middle of the night, sometime many weeks later, that it dawned on me that, wait a minute, that's actually a faulty assumption, that the fact is that many confessions do occur to law enforcement officials, but by law in Oregon, a confession doesn't have to be to a law enforcement official.
Mr. James, let me just get through this. I think the question really was, have you had this discussion with the representatives regarding this new discovered issue?
We have. I'm sorry for not directly answering. I misunderstood.
That's fine. Thank you.
Yes, we have discussed this with Representative Gelser. As a result, I believe it was the -5 amendments that she has put in recently, which requires the consideration of the relationship between the defendant and the person to whom the defendant confessed. We agree that that takes a step towards perhaps mitigating against false confessions or maliciously reported confessions and ultimately false convictions. And we commend her for taking that step. We still believe legally there is sort of a hole in the bill And I'm in no way here to suggest that it is a fatally deficient hole. It's certainly, it's a public policy choice for this committee to make. We would suggest if this troubles you, the easy solution is to simply limit the exception to confessions to law enforcement or federal officers. I can relate to you that I think the one area where our proposed fix maybe doesn't capture Representative Gelser's intent is the definitions of peace officer and federal officer under Oregon statute don't encompass, for instance, DHS workers who are investigating allegations.
Correct.
We've looked for statutory definitions of those people, and unfortunately there really is no consistent statutory definition to include them there. So I think that would be the response as to why perhaps this proposed fix doesn't quite fix it enough.
Thank you.
So let me tell you where we're at. The question from Mr. James, please.
I, as often is the case, I'm confused by the law. But wouldn't a confession made to from citizen A to citizen B, and citizen B went to the court and said that he confessed, wouldn't that be hearsay evidence?
It would not, because in the Senator, what's it?
Fine.
Chairman. It wouldn't, because a statement by a party opponent, in this case the defendant in a criminal trial, is non-hearsay.
Declaration against interest. There's an exception to the hearsay.
Okay.
All right. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to close the public hearing at this point. We're not working the bill, and since both of you can come back and give testimony later, I've got another bill I want to get going. And so I do want to find out, there's one other person that did sign up for this bill, which was Sidney Stoller. Sydney, are you able to stay here for a little bit? Or I'm not sure. I'll tell you what, come on up and let's take your testimony real quick before I close this public hearing, and then we're going to open up the next one to get Senator Burdick up here and on her way. Yes.
My name is Sidney Stoller. I live in King City with my wife. We're parents and guardians of our adult daughter who suffers mental impairment in the severe degree. Now, for your education, in case you don't know, in a mental retardation, there is moderate, that's a mild, moderate, severe, and profound. So when you get down to severe, you're far down the ladder. She was for some years in a private nonprofit but licensed agency here in the state of Oregon, and we poured a lot of money and our time into that agency to make it succeed. And in 1985, we were called in by the director and told that she'd been sexually abused. Well, she'd been misbehaving for some time, but we didn't recognize at that time the characteristics of somebody who has been abused in that way, which we of course do today. She was denied by the district attorney the right to, or we were denied the right of further relief because of the fact that she was an unreliable witness. She was so angry she could not stay at that facility. We had to take her home, put her in a private psychiatric hospital, keep her at home for a while. Then she went to Fairview, where remarkably she improved. And we're hoping that you will find a way to pass this bill, because what happened to the abuser? Well, he went on to another agency for mentally impaired people to work there, right in this state. I don't know where he is today. As a member of the VOR, which is an advocacy organization, we've heard from Marion and Randy Nunnenkamp, who used to be from the Washington County Sheriff's Office and have gone around the state giving seminars on child abuse and abuse of impaired people. And from Dan Noel, the former sheriff of Multnomah County, and from Ava Kutis of the Office of Investigations and Training, Department of Human Services, and they've all said the same thing, how difficult it is to prosecute these kind of individuals. And I'm going to conclude my little testimony here by thanking Senator Gessler, hoping you'll find a way to pass this into the law. It is very badly needed, and to assure you that we have to live with the consequences of this still today, over 25 years later. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stoller, stay there just for a second. Colleagues, are there any questions for Mr. Stoller?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming forward and being willing to tell the story today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this point on 2441A. And for
The two Myers, if you stay in the room, we may come back to this after we get through the next one. We're now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2727A. And send a verdict. Okay, well, I was going to suggest is why don't we bring a fourth chair up. We'll bring Commissioner Leonard, Senator Burdick, and you said Mr. Caldwell, and then I...
And Mr. Gleason.
And I was going to say, and bring Tim up, too. That way we have four. And I apologize for our schedule, as hectic as it is. Thank you for being willing to accommodate the schedule of the committee. Senator Burdick, if you'd like to start off.
Our pleasure, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your courtesies in having this panel. My name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, including your last witness from King City. I am here in opposition to House Bill 2727. I do want to commend the chair of the House Judiciary Committee for trying to work with this bill to balance a lot of different interests. Unfortunately, it is impossible to put up barriers at any time to public regarding concealed handgun licenses without causing some real damage to the credibility of our public safety system. I'm not going to testify at length. I do, however, want to explain a handout that's being distributed to you. One of the things that I am persuaded, and again, I do favor transparency in government and open and public records. However, I'm very sympathetic to the plight of people who are the victims of violence or feel a threat to their safety. And so my legislative assistant looked into the existing protections for people in that category, and she found very strong provisions in the existing law for victims of domestic violence or people who are being threatened in some way where they can get their information exempted from all public records, not just these. And so with that, I have a lot of points that I'd like to make about this, but I want to allow the other folks up here at the panel who have come from some distance to have more time for their testimony. So I will be here available for questions and turn it over to the rest of the panel.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Krasanski and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Randy Leonard. I'm a member of the Portland City Council, a former member of this body. And it's really been fun for me to be back in this room that I've spent so many hours in on that side of the dais a number of years ago. I'm in here in opposition to House Bill 2727. Interestingly, when I was in the legislature, one of Portland's newspapers did a public records request to find out which members of the legislature may have had a concealed weapons permit. At that time, I had a concealed weapons permit. And although it was made quite public that I had one, not only did I not suffer any adverse consequences, people that hadn't been so nice to me in the past were pretty nice where they thought I might be packing. So I've had a hard time understanding this argument that by publicizing concealed weapons permit holders, it somehow makes people more vulnerable. I think that kind of defies common sense. I think the actual dynamic is that if people are aware somebody owns and may even possess a weapon, they would be less likely to be targeted as victims. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. And if you need to leave, feel free to leave whenever you need to. All right, Bob or Tim, whoever wants to go next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2727 and 2727A. My name is Bob Caldwell. I live in Portland, and I am testifying on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. This bill, of course, would have the effect of closing public access to concealed weapons permits in every county in the state. I oppose the legislation. It's not a bill that in any way protects Oregonians' right to keep and bear arms. The bill is about the public's right to keep the access it has to the records of basic government systems, in this case the granting of the privilege to carry concealed weapons. The bill flies in the face of the state of Oregon's stated policy of generally requiring that the public's records remain open to the public, and the policy of erring on the side of openness rather than government secrecy. Beyond that, I believe the legislation poses a much wider problem for open government in the state, because it adopts the reasoning of a court decision that's now under appeal. The development, I think, prompting this bill was an unprecedentedly broad court interpretation that transformed an open records exemption intended to keep Oregon's security plans out of the hands of terrorists and turned it into a gaping loophole and closing basic public records instead. This is never the intent of Oregon legislators who included the security exemption in RS 192.501. The court interpretation offered last year in the concealed weapons case in Jackson County is under appeal to the Court of Appeals, and despite that appeal, the ruling prompted Washington County Sheriff to send out letters inviting holders of concealed weapons permits to declare a security concern, which he would then address by erasing the concealed weapons permits from public view. If the legislature needs to fix something here, it would be to shore up and clarify RS 192.501 so that the meaning of security exemptions intended to protect plans to protect public officials or public facilities from being so badly misconstrued. The Medford case was really about whether or not public employees were following, or a particular public employee was following, the policies of her employer. And as you know, public employees or private employers don't get to usually choose between policies that they follow and policies that they won't follow. The bill also removes a means to check the quality of the work done by local sheriff's offices. Comparing concealed weapons permits against, say, public records of arrests or jail releases could provide the public with a helpful insight into the quality of the sheriff's judgment and his or her performance in office. In a world where the public demands more and more accountability from its public officials, it seems counter to widespread sentiment to remove public records from the hands of the public. Since the passage of the Open Records Law nearly four decades ago, Oregon has worked hard to uphold the public's right to follow the actions and transactions of its public officials. When exemptions have been made, some care has been taken to strike a balance between the competing rights of democratic governments and personal privacy. This bill were approved by the Oregon legislature, the balance, I feel, would be shifted sharply away from open government and public access. I believe it's the wrong direction for this legislature to take our state. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Tim? Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tim Gleason. I live in Eugene, Oregon. And just for purposes of identification, I am the Dean of the School of Journalism at the University of Oregon, and also sit on the board of directors of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association and of Open Oregon. However, my testimony today is my own. I am not representing the University of Oregon or acting in my capacity as a member of the university administration or faculty. In the interest of time, let me skip a number of parts of my prepared remarks and go to what I think is the heart of the matter. I speak in opposition to 2727. I commend the work of the in the House. I think that they went a long way in moving this bill from its initial configuration to where it now stands. And I encourage this body, if it's going to move this bill, to move even further in the direction that the House began. When the House of Representatives moved this amendment into ORS 192502 and provided for at least a minimal limited right of access to the records, it began to address the concerns raised about the original proposal. It recognized that the right of privacy asserted by advocates of closure needs to be balanced against Oregon's long-held and basic commitment to open and transparent government. If concealed handgun license records are going to be taken out of the public domain, this body needs to continue that work. As currently drafted, the bill is weighted too far on the side of protecting a somewhat general assertion of a privacy need that is far less specific and targeted than the privacy interest this body has recognized in creating narrowly crafted exemptions intended to protect individuals from clearly identified harms that could reasonably be expected should personal identifying information be in the public domain. I would note that to a significant degree, this bill is redundant, that the privacy interests asserted by the advocates of this bill are fully addressed in the personal privacy exemption that already exists in 192.502, if in fact there are privacy interests in play here. However, if this bill is to be moved, the exemption should be moved into 192.501. The effectiveness of the balancing test in 501, which requires that the requester show that the public interest requires disclosure in their particular instance, has been tested over the history of public records law. The standard in the current bill, by clear and convincing evidence, establishes a threshold that has the potential to be nearly insurmountable. That threshold is even higher given the clear disposition toward closure of the proposed custodians of these records. It may be more difficult by the provision in the bill that allows the permit holder to request notification that a request has been made. It is puzzling to me that the 501 standard, which is sufficient to protect personal information of, for example, public safety officers and district attorneys, where a very clear danger to their personal safety has been identified, that the 501 standard is sufficient for that interest and yet not sufficient to protect the less specific privacy interests of concealed weapon permit holders. Also, to the extent that an exemption is justified, I urge the committee to sharpen the focus. As written, the entire record is exempt. Privacy interests could be served by more clearly defining the potential harm and perhaps exempting, for example, street addresses, driver's license information, and other data that reveals a specific home address while leaving the name of permit holders in the public domain. I encourage these revisions, even though I believe that advocates of closure have failed to overcome what should be a fundamental tenet of state government. In every instance where the state licenses individuals, the licensing process and outcome should be transparent, absent a compelling public interest in closure. This standard is not met when the argument is that closure would be more convenient, comfortable, or efficient. The standard requires that advocates show that openness is not in the public interest, and that the scope of the closure is no greater than necessary to serve the public interest. It is my understanding that there are upwards of 100,000 concealed weapon permit holders in the state of Oregon. HB 2727, as written, would effectively remove any public check on potential abuse of the licensing process. The public interest will be better served by a bill that truly protects transparency and serves the public interest in open government. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Senator Boquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Collin, I need you to clarify for me. I think when you gave your testimony, you indicated you were representing the Oregon Newspaper Association.
Yes.
But your written testimony says you're not. So clarifying that.
And should revise that.
And then my question would be, because I'm obviously when it passed the House, my email and phone lit up right after the editor of the Newberg Graphic published an editorial. In which it says the Oregon House of Representatives took a step in the right direction when it passed a bill allowing continued limited access to information. And then it goes on to say the newspaper will still have access under the House law as passed to get lists of teachers who have concealed weapons permits.
It's not my understanding.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
They were confused.
Right. Questions? Thank you all very much.
Mr. I do have a follow-up question. I think either the dean or the newspaper, in the newspaper's eyes, you said a clear and convincing would almost be an impossible hurdle. Can you give me an example of what you think clear and convincing? Because my concern is this is going to be litigated.
The clear and convincing standard has a fairly limited history in public records law. In Oregon public records, I believe the only place it's found is in the personal privacy exemption where there is a fairly long, both at the state and federal level, fairly long history and not a particularly clear history of what the standard means. And in that instance, it's a little hard to know how it would be interpreted because there are two other pieces to that exemption that play a significant role in determining what's open or not. So I think it's nearly insurmountable in that, A, it's unknown what exactly it means, and two, we know it's a significantly higher standard than the one that exists in 501.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, if I could just add to that, the entity that decides whether there is sufficient evidence is the entity, at least at the initial stage, is the entity that issues the permit. So if someone felt like it was possible that the sheriff's office had stopped, for example, doing background checks on applicants and wanted to do a public records request and see what kind of folks were getting these permits, then it would be the sheriff who would be deciding what met the threshold. So it's really when it comes to oversight, it's a fox in the chicken coop type of situation, potentially. We all know our sheriffs would never do such a thing, but it's always good to have oversight.
Thank you, sir. Question of legal counsel?
I think we discussed the step process. We believe the request would go to the sheriff. If the sheriff said no, the sheriff would go to the district attorney. Is that the process? So
I believe the process is that if you're an elected official, you either go to the district attorney or the AG's office of courts. But in any case, the next step is to the courts.
The third step is the courts.
I believe if you're an elected official, the sheriff, then the third step would be the courts. Otherwise, in other cases, it's the person makes a decision, and then it goes right to the courts for appeal.
So in the case, if someone came in and asked that the sheriff said no, that individual could then go to the district attorney, the attorney general's office,
yes,
with that request, and it would be reviewed, and then the third step would be going to court.
That's my understanding, yes. I am not a public records expert, but asking an LC, yes.
Thank you, sir.
I can't give any clarification. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask the panel, typically when we're looking at legislation, we try to figure out what the problem is that we're trying to solve and how the proposed legislation would solve the problem. So what I'm wondering with this particular bill is, has there been, for example, a problem with lists published and then the permit holders being targeted somehow? Or what is the problem that's been identified that we're trying to solve with this bill that you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I've been working on gun issues for over 10 years, and I have never come across a case where someone was revealed to have a permit and then some negative consequence came to them. I find that if I want to know if someone has a permit, I just ask them and they just tell me. Same with gun ownership. I asked if somebody owns a gun and they just tell me. I've not heard one instance of a bad consequence, and I've been working on this issue for my entire legislative career.
And I wonder, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, from the dean of my alma mater, Journalism School, or from Mr. Caldwell, are you aware of any instances where there have been lists, for example, published of concealed license holders?
I'm unaware of any complete list published anywhere by newspapers, let's say, or on the internet of complete lists of permit holders. I do know that the Medford Mail Tribune, I guess it's last year now, requested a list, which it then compared to the lists of people who are employed by a local school district in order to determine whether whether anybody else who worked for the school district was carrying a concealed weapon in violation of the school district's no weapons policy. But it did not publish such a list.
All right, Senator Bonamici, Chair, Mr. Chair, I am aware of at least one instance in another state where a firestorm erupted when a newspaper did publish a database of license holders. However, it's not at all clear that firestorm was grounded in any real potential harm. It seemed more to be people just didn't like the fact that information was a public record. But as to any real harm, I believe Senator Burdick has expressed the situation exactly correctly, that there's no evidence that I'm aware of anyone ever having a problem as a result of this information being a public record, which, as you know, it has been in the state of Oregon for a very long time.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
For the record, as a former senator, state representative, Leonard.
Both.
Former elected official and now commissioner mentioned when he was in the legislature that you know, the list came out and he was on it and was interviewed. And during the last legislative session, I don't remember which of the two TV stations that's in the basement had the list. And I, of course, was the first person out the door, literally walking out of the committee, and they were waving the list on TV and you know, are you packing heat, so on and so forth like that. And I had a similar reaction than you did. So
people are a lot nicer to you.
That's right.
All right, Senator Wista.
Probably a little different take on it than the panel does. My personal belief is that a person has the constitutional right to carry an arm in any way they wish. The state lawmakers in Oregon have decided in their wisdom that we should limit that right to those who are trained and capable and are not dangerous to others. And I see no reason why we should be publicizing that right to carry an arm any more than we should be publicizing the right to do any other of our reserved rights as citizens. So I see no reason. In addition to that, I have a box in my office that has 3,500 signatures from my district alone, actually from Klamath County, which is one of five counties of people who think that that information should not be disclosed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. My next panel is going to be Kevin Sterling, Don Phillips, who I understand is going to be introducing Rachel, maybe? And Dan Lucas. Mr. Lucas, you may need to bring a chair up with you, sir.
For the record, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Starrett with the Oregon Firearms Federation. 2727 was a bill that was written after a Medford newspaper demanded the names of all the CHL holders in their county as a result of a lawsuit that we filed on behalf of a Medford teacher. And contrary to what you've heard from other people, people have been harmed by the release of this information. This teacher was threatened and harassed, not because she had a gun, but because it was found out that she had a license. And as I've testified in the House committee, there are entire businesses that are predisposed to being opposed to firearms rights, and that information should be kept private. The Medford Mail Tribune wanted a list of all the other teachers who had CHLs for the obvious reason of outing them and harassing them. The editorial that Senator Boquist mentioned before not only said that the Newberg graphic will still have access to license holders' names, but they went on to say that they've used it in the past to identify teachers who were carrying guns in school, which, of course, they'd have absolutely no way of knowing whether they were carrying a gun in school simply because they had a license. But the bill you have now in front of you doesn't really serve the purpose it was intended to serve. No one's records are protected under this version of the bill. It included a few pages of legal opinions provided by legislative counsel, excuse me, to make it clear that CHL records will not be protected. License holders will still have their personal information made available, just as it has been in my county, where the sheriff turned over these sensitive private records to a group that wanted to raise money. I've given you a copy of their fundraiser. It's the second one she's received. My wife received this fundraiser because she has a license. Excuse me. Now that organization that has these license holders' names not only can use it to generate revenue, but they're free to sell that list to anyone else. So my wife's address, phone number, and the fact that she's a gun owner and other personal information can be sold because the sheriff of Clackamas County chose to reveal this information for people who wanted to use it for a direct mail pitch. The people who want to keep these records public, as this bill actually does, have made the case that they're non-sensitive government documents. They are not non-sensitive. The documents exist because, as Senator Whitsitt pointed out, Oregonians are required by law to pay a fee and divulge personal information to exercise what other states consider a right. They shouldn't be any more public than tax or medical records. Open government is so that people can keep track of what you people are doing as government actors, not so that they can pry into the private affairs of their neighbors. I think it's kind of ironic that here in this system, if I request a bill, I'm only allowed to see amendments to that bill if I'm given permission. Now, that's not open government, but people who have apply for licenses in order to comply with the law, now have their information made public. And as you've heard from previous speakers, newspapers and others fully intend to keep making that public. And so we think that if you're going to do something with this bill, it's very important that you make some attempt to return the original protections that were in the first version of the bill and not pass a bill that is kind of smoke and mirrors and provides no protection for anyone.
All right. Thank you. Before we take any more testimony, I want to make a statement to everyone that's in the audience, and I need to apologize. I already told individuals that are here for House Bill 2339 that we would not be moving that today, and I believe we're setting that over until the 26th of May, which is Tuesday. It just come to my attention that House Bill 2238, we have some issues with that. I know there are some people in the room for 2238, and I apologize for not telling you. I just realized that there may be a mistake on the drafting on that, so we're not going to be hearing that. So if you're here on the two work session bills, they will not be moving today. I am going to go ahead and list 2238 for the 26th, so we can carry that over and not get it lost, so it won't get lost in the system. And I apologize for those for not giving that word out prior to then. All right, carrying on with the testimony, Ms. Phillips, did you want to go ahead and introduce Rachel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And before I introduce Rachel, I would like to clarify a couple of things for the record, if I may. Representative Thatcher.
You made ID yourself.
Yes, I'm sorry. Don Phillips, Policy Director for State Representative Kim Thatcher. And Representative Thatcher and I have been working on this bill for over a year now, and pretty much night and day as the session has gone on, working amendments and working with the various parties on this. And so I just want to clarify a couple of things for the record that have been said so far today. On the issue of clear and convincing evidence, there is nothing in the bill that requires the court to use that standard, only for the holder, the public body that has the records that are being requested. And so when you ask someone that you say you have clear and convincing evidence, that's in the eye of the beholder that has those records, and they get to decide what is clear and convincing evidence. And we do believe there will be litigation as a result of all that. Secondly, there are other agencies besides the sheriff that have these records, and you could go over to DHS and ask them for a list of all the foster parents that they have on file that have concealed handgun licenses, and under the public records laws, they probably would have to give that to you. So just keep in mind it's not just the sheriff. Also, in regards to clear and convincing evidence, if I'm an abusive spouse, I may not have a criminal record. I may want to know if my wife has a concealed handgun license. There's no obligation of the sheriff to investigate me as the abusive spouse to find out what my motive is or what the situation is with my wife. As far as, you know, the question that I believe Senator Bonamici asked, what is the problem? And Senator Whitsitt mentioned the box in his office with 3,500 statements that were given by the concealed handgun owners in his district. We typed up all those statements, and we have 1,400 reasons here. These are the problems. These are the people that fear this information is going to be released. These are folks who are former DAs, current police officers, abuse victims, identity theft victims, people who carry large sums of money for their business. The list goes on. And we've now heard from folks, this is having a chilling effect. They're no longer going in and getting concealed handgun licenses because they're afraid their information is going to be released. Senator Burdick handed you a handout that talked about a vague section of the law that puts the onus back on the concealed handgun owner, which this bill does a lot of that, to know that this is available for them to go in and request that their personal address and phone number not be released. This is a copy of 22 of the state counties, of the county's applications for concealed handgun licenses. The information on here goes way beyond your home phone number and your home address. It asks you how many guns you have in the house and what kind. Did you have a dishonorable discharge from the military? Are you using controlled substances?
Don.
So there's a lot of personal information. Yes, sir.
We've got two other people who wanted to give testimony. What you were supposed to be doing was ID.
I want to introduce Rachel now because I think she can wrap this up for you. And we want to thank the committee and the chair for allowing us to introduce Rachel. We've been working with her. She is an abuse victim and a crime victim, and we did not want to use her last name or her address.
And I'm going to be very frank with you right now. I've asked for a request as to whether she can come in and testify without giving her full name. And she can, so go right ahead.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Rachel, and I thank you for hearing me without having me be required to give my full name, and I'll explain to you why that's important to me. I appear before you today to urge you to pass HB 2727 and to pass it with its original safeguards to privacy. I am very concerned about how the amendments in HB 2727A water down the original bill. I was the victim of a violent sexual assault by a stranger, and I obtained my CHL for my own personal protection. The story of what happened to me was reported in the local paper, and back then the media was careful to protect me, and they, in fact, worked hard to keep my identity private. Likewise, in court, my privacy was shielded because the county brought the charges against the perpetrator, and I was subpoenaed by the county as a witness to the case. In all cases, care was taken to protect my privacy. I was willing to notify the police and testify in court in order to protect myself and other potential victims from this man. And it was worth it because he was put safely behind bars. But I still bear the scars. In some ways, they never really go away. No matter how much time passes, you always feel that vulnerability and fear re-victimization in a very primal way. Having a CHL helps empower me to protect myself and my family. It also helps heal the wounds of vulnerability and victimization from a time when I couldn't defend myself from harm. But now I have another fear. I frequently worry that my perpetrator will harbor resentment towards me and seek me out after his release. Knowing that I can protect myself and my family helps to allay those fears. Having my private information made public actually re-violates me and takes away that safety. It gives my perpetrator access to my private information and exposes me publicly, all because I sought to legally protect myself. The information I was required to put on these forms in order to obtain my CHL is detailed, extensive, and highly personal. The revisions in HB 2727A, although well-intentioned, do not effectively protect my information from being released. I am a law-abiding citizen who bravely put myself forward to help protect others. Please pass HB 2727 in its original form for the safety and security of crime victims, private citizens, and your constituents. Thank you for your consideration.
All right, thank you. Mr. Lucas.
Good morning. I'm Dan Lucas, and I live in Beaverton. I'm here today to ask you to please pass House Bill 2727 in its original form. The current law is completely inadequate in protecting CHL holders' private information, and HB 2727A still gives too much latitude to the CHL record custodians. Commenting on House Bill 2727A, Representative Thatcher wrote in a recent editorial for the Newburgh Graphic, quote, House Bill 2727 unfortunately still allows access to records of concealed handgun license holders. It simply provides a process to get that information and gives the sheriff broad discretion, end quote. Putting this broad discretion back out on the CHL record custodians has been demonstrated to be a bad idea. The current law leaves the sheriffs twisting in the wind regarding when they are required or permitted to release CHL application information and which information should or can be redacted. An Associated Press Oregon Freedom of Information audit conducted as a part of Sunshine Week 2005 revealed a significant lack of uniformity in how private CHL application information is handled by different counties. And I've given this as a handout. And if you look on here, it shows you that the different counties handle these identical requests, all, and it's all over the map. The exact same requests by volunteer auditors across the state resulted in some counties correctly denying access to the private information, some counties turning over the five most recent CHL applications as requested, and sheriff's offices in at least two counties, Lane and Deschutes, expressing willingness to provide the auditors with their entire list of CHL holders. A 2005 article written for the Bend Bulletin revealed the then Deschutes County Sheriff would have no problem releasing the roughly 5,000 names of people with concealed weapons permits in the county after redacting Social Security numbers and personal medical information. However, Deschutes County CHL application also contains address, other states lived in as an adult, home and work phone numbers, employer, occupation, date of birth, height, weight, residences for the last 3 years, names, addresses, and phone numbers of two character references, as well as the answers to citizenship and criminal history questions. In 2007, a third county, Multnomah, went beyond expressing a willingness and actually turned over their entire database of 12,000 CHL holders to the Oregonian, where they went on to harass teachers.
The current broad discretion given to sheriffs and the lack of clarity in the law is not fixed in 2727A. Besides inappropriately placing it into the public record law, 2727A also continues to grant broad discretion to sheriffs with the unclear requirement in ORS 193-502-35B that to obtain private CHL information, the requester needs to, quote, show by clear and convincing evidence that the public interest requires disclosure in the particular instance, end quote. The determination of what constitutes clear and convincing evidence is still left up to the record custodian. The whole door opened in 35B, and especially the phrase that the public interest requires disclosure in the particular instance, effectively moves private CHL information into the much more open portion of the public record law 192-501. As such, it will continue to be relatively easy for news organizations and others to obtain this private information, and coupled with the broad discretion still granted to sheriffs by 2727A, results of future audits would likely produce the same inconsistent protection of private CHL records as documented in the 2005 audit. For these reasons, I ask you to please protect CHL holders' private information by passing 2727 in its original form. Thank you, and thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Before we do questions, I'm just going to put something on the record here. As you know, we have a, a bicameral process. Something's happened in the House. We now have the bill that's before us, which is 2727A. If we go back to the original, which would be 2727, it has to go back for either concurrence or non-concurrence. Knowing the chair's position, you can bet that it's not going to be concurred with if we went back, which would mean we'd go into, at best, a conference committee, which basically would mean that probably the bill would not go forward, and whatever the state of the law currently is going to stay intact. So with that, I'm going to take questions, if there are any questions, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Serlich one question and response, and get a response to what my statement was. So if we did, let's say, hypothetically, take this bill, return it to its original form, 2727, and it went into a conference committee, and no agreement was able to be worked out as to what, quote-unquote, would be a compromise that was voted in favor of both by the House and the Senate, then that means we'd be right where we're at today. And would that be your preference?
Chairman Prasansky, my feeling is that this law contains no benefits for license holders, so it wouldn't matter for us one way or the other. Okay. Currently, sheriffs are making an effort to protect license holders to whatever extent they can. I would prefer to see no law rather than a law that was created for political purposes rather than policy purposes.
All right, fair enough. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I have three other people that were signed up, and I don't know if they still want to testify. Rod Harder, John Powell, and Andrea Meyer. You are obvious, you understand the situation and time we're in. I'm starting to lose members, so if you can be brief, that would be great. And Mr. Harder, why don't you start?
For the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2727A. It bears no resemblance, as you know, to the bill that you co-sponsored in the House and has gone through a number of machinations. And I agree with the folks that were up here previously that it does not offer the protections that we sought in the beginning. We're staying neutral on this bill because it does offer the sheriff some things that you do not currently have. For the committee's information, and some of the people who testified previously have testified at the applications, according to debate on the House floor, applications would also be covered under this disclosure. They contain Social Security numbers, they contain names and addresses of your two character witnesses, and a much other personal information that doesn't seem to be addressed by the news people and some of the others. Again, we are going to remain neutral on this. In the interest of time, I think most of my testimony has been covered somewhere else or by someone else.
Thank you, Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Powell representing Oregon's 36 county sheriffs. Mr. Chairman, I'm just simply going to rely on your questions and comments to the previous panel for our testimony. The bill was amended in the House in its current form, and we're willing to go forward with this language and implement it and see how it works. We do believe this is a step in the right direction. We think it creates a balancing test that protects the rights of the community at the same time protecting the personal information of the applicants. So we would urge passage of the bill as you receive it in the annual form. Thank you.
All right. And Ms. Meyer.
Members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the ACLU, here today in opposition to House Bill 2727. I was not available on the House side, but ONPA more than adequately represented our concerns, as ACLU has done in House Consumer Protection on an accident report public record bill. So, and I will be before this committee next week. I will simply join the previous testimony from Mr. Gleason and Mr. Caldwell and point out two other concerns that I want to identify for the committee. This is an important check on government, and obviously there is the balancing of the privacy rights versus the check on the government. But one thing specifically to point out is that the records that will not be available are not just of people who have applied and received a license, but also those applicants who have been denied. And again, that is a check on the sheriff doing their job to ensure that people who are not to obtain these licenses don't. And so I want to recognize that those documents would also be unavailable. Also, I'm concerned about the sort of the delay and the timeline related to a custodian actually responding to the records, because page 10 of the bill requires that the sheriff contact the holder or applicant if the sheriff receives a request for disclosure that affects that holder or applicant. So only upon receiving a public record request must the sheriff then go back to each individual, and depending on the number of records actually requested, that would be a significant, if not a full barrier fiscally, on any local custodian or state custodian of these records from actually even ever getting to the answer to the record requester. It does not describe any timeline upon which the holder of the license must respond. Before then, back on page 7 of the bill, the custodian will evaluate and make a decision if there's clear and convincing evidence, a standard that also causes us concern, and would again urge that something like this be put in the 501 when we're doing a public interest test. So I wanted to issue spot those, I think, important things that had not yet been identified, and be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Just for the record, council has looked on page 10, our reading of the requirement to contact the applicant or the holder is that they have requested it. In other words, if the sheriff has something on file stating that they don't care if their record is released, they wouldn't have to contact them. At least that's
right.
Our reading of that.
Right. Chair Pozanski, right. In line 18, you begin with the applicant shall indicate if they don't want to be subject to public disclosure. I'm not an expert. I think I've heard anecdotally. I mean, I think when this has been offered, many, many folks have checked that box, so to speak. So I think it would be safe to say there would be a significant number who would check the box upon which the custodian would then have the obligation upon a public records request to contact them.
All right. Any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you all very much. I'm just going to check. I don't know if I don't have anyone else signed up, but did anyone else want to give testimony on 2727A? Not hearing that, we're closing the public hearing on 2727A. And council, let's go through our list here and make sure we've got everything on that we want. Okay. All right. I'm going to open up a public hearing real quick on House Bill 2478A. Just see if there's anyone else in the room. This is Representative Braun's bill. Not seeing anyone. Closing that public hearing. And we're going to carry that one over to the 26th, which will be Tuesday, May 26th. And on 2441, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. That one there, we had a few people that still wanted to give testimony on that one. I believe Gil Meyer and Andrew Meyer still wanted to give testimony. I'm going to carry that one over till tomorrow. So we're carrying over 2441A, trying to get all the public testimony in on that. And then I'm going to go through all these others. 2478A, 2727A, and 3271A. Those are being carried over until Tuesday, May 26th. And as I just stated, the one just before it, House Bill 2441A, will be carried over until tomorrow. I think that covers And then just to make sure that we've done everything on the two that were set for work session, House Bill 2238, as well as 2339A, those are carried over until Tuesday, May 26. With that, we're adjourned for the day, and we're back here tomorrow at 8.